My name is Laura. I'm excited to be back with you guys. Hopefully you're not tired of me yet. And if you are, well, too bad. I'm still here. So today I'm really excited for this panel to have Carissa Miller and Wendy Hetherington join us today, share some of their knowledge. I'm really excited to learn from them and hear about these firsthand experiences of incorporating equity into the process. And so with no further kind of intro, we're going to go right over to Carissa. And so here you go.
Thank you. All right, now I did add my two slides to the beginning, but it looks like they took them out. So as she said, I'm Carissa Miller. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. Pronouns are she and her. So I know earlier in the discussion, sorry, I gotta get that adjusted. Earlier throughout this conversation, we've talked a lot about identities and the kind of intersection of identities. So I have my LCSW, and it's not a certification, it's actually a license in the state of Indiana from university, my degree is from University of Southern California. I'm actually in clinical practice, including substance use treatment, since 2016. I have been on the CEAS of Scott County leadership since 2018 and the SOFR coordinator since 2022. I am the president-elect for the Indiana chapter of National Association of Social Workers, and that caveat of all these comments are mine and not necessarily the views of organizations with which I am affiliated. Oh, there's my site data. So Scott County is a rural county in southern Indiana. Our coalition serves the entire county, but the county seat is Scottsburg. A lot of people know of Austin, Indiana, because in 2015 we had an HIV epidemic. Because of that HIV epidemic, we had a lot of resources flooded in for a few years, and then they've kind of waned away over the last several years. So that kind of changed how we looked at things. Our estimated number of overdose deaths per year is 18. I will say our preliminary data for 2023 is 9, which is really exciting. We cover 192 square miles, a population of 24,000, so you can see it's a really small community. Our funding sources are NCARES ECHO, which is actually our OD2A funding. We are a ONDCP drug-free communities community, and then we also have some funding from a program called Seek Common Ground, which I'll get to later. The recommendation was to identify and create LGBTQIA plus supports for teens and young adults. At the time of the recommendation, we needed more research to really kind of specify what that looked like. We recognized that as our SOFR team, we really weren't sure what exactly those supports needed were. So you've heard nothing about us without us. That's kind of what led to kind of our next steps. So a little bit of background. The first SOFR year, we only reviewed overdose fatalities because of the funding stream that we had. So all fatalities are reviewed in our county regardless of, so we review all Scott County residents, whether they passed away in another county or within our county. We also review all overdose fatalities that occur within Scott County. So of the decedents that we reviewed, 50% of our female decedents identified as LGBTQIA+. To put that into perspective, 12.5% of our total decedents identified as LGBTQIA+, where the state percent or the average kind of estimated is 4.5%. So you can see there's some pretty significant health disparity there. Our next of kin interviews indicated that the disclosure of sexual identity for the first time is kind of what either drove the onset of substance use or escalated substance use pretty significantly. We are from, out of that 129 square miles, I think there are probably about 129 churches. And the community is not super receptive to LGBTQIA plus identities. So, again, with the nothing about us, without us, we decided we were going to hold some listening sessions. So we reached out to our school counselors. We reached out to some specific teachers that we knew were safe spaces for LGBTQIA+. We also spoke to, like as a clinician, I spoke to some of the youth that were in services that identified it as LGBTQIA+, and they invited their friends. We did not publicly advertise our listening sessions for safety reasons. So as far as the space considerations go, we wanted to make sure that there was a safe space discussion and a list of expectations about what that looks like. We held the sessions in a location known to be LGBTQIA+ friendly. We also included openly LGBTQIA+ individuals to co-lead those sessions so that it wasn't a cisgendered white woman having a conversation with youth. So what we heard is that our attendees of these listening sessions identified the same struggles that had been identified in the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network 2021 National School Climate Survey. So they hear biased remarks in school, they feel unsafe, there's chronic absenteeism due to those safety reasons, they are experiencing harassment and assault within their schools, and they're experiencing discriminatory practices and policies within their schools. So it's not just within our schools, there's that community spread. So last summer in June, we had a street preacher that harassed a same-sex business for months, probably 3 months. And that was supposedly within his right to free speech to be able to stand on the sidewalk in front of a business and make statements. This is a direct quote from one of his videos. "I love being in homosexuals' pictures," the man said in one of his videos, while someone apparently was taking a picture of him out of frame. "Okay, kids, avert your eyes, sexual perverts at work," he continued. So this went on for months, and this business that was being preached at was, I mean, on the same corner as the place where the youth were meeting and where we had held these listening sessions not that long before. So we also, throughout this program or progress, had started a group called Rainbow After the Storm. So some of the local business owners within our community had made comments on Rainbow After the Storm social media posts, encouraging them to connect with this Courage RC, which is essentially conversion therapy. There was another quote from a trans woman that said, "I can't find a primary care in this county to treat me. They all say they don't know how to deal with, quote unquote, those issues. I get a cold just like anyone else," is what she said. So throughout our community, we're seeing this anti-LGBTQIA sentiment. On top of that, we have some state legislation that went through last year. HEA 1608 is where schools must identify sexual identity to parents. So that's kind of a don't say gay bill. We also had a SEA 480, which is a ban on gender affirming care. So Gleason report, the one that I had mentioned earlier, they had some recommendations in there of creating gender sexuality alliances or similar clubs, LGBTQIA+ inclusivity in curriculums, supportive school staff, supportive and inclusive school policies such as anti-bullying policies, harassment policies, and transgender and non-binary student policies. So what we did is we held these listening sessions, we created a power map where these youth and young adults were able to kind of learn more about the individuals within their sphere of influence, where they felt like they aligned as far as what the youth had wanted for their goals, and how influential those people were. So we kind of had that conversation. If you're not familiar with power mapping, the people that oppose you and hold no influence really don't matter. Right? But the people that oppose you and are very influential, some of what you have to look at is how do we change hearts and minds and shift them to be more aligned with what we want. People that are influential and support you, let's connect and kind of partner. And then sometimes you have people that support you that have no influence, and they're great to still be involved in some of those conversations. So some of what the youth had decided they wanted was the GSAs in the school districts. So one of our school districts had initially created a GSA, but it was on a virtual platform because that was during COVID. And that hadn't gone so well. There was a lot of hate speech. And so this iteration, the initial school district that had the GSA was able to revise and come up with kind of a vetting process for youth to be included in that GSA club at school. The youth actually went to the school board at the other school district and were able to get approved a GSA in the larger school district that had actually denied GSAs within the schools for several years. So the youth group actually wanted a safe and inclusive space within their own community. So something that was outside of schools, what we have found was that a lot of them that were involved were high school seniors and felt like GSAs within the schools were great for the youth that were still gonna be in school or the youth that were younger than them and coming up, but they wanted that opportunity to be able to create more spaces within the community. And so they created Rainbow After the Storm group. This bottom left picture is a photo of some of the young adults that we have involved in our group. And so the youth were actually able to create a list of goals for their group, and then they worked toward those goals. So the adults that were initially involved in creating this have kind of stepped back, and the youth have taken this on and taken ownership of their own organization. So we also got school policies changed. So now there are preferred names that are used. Of course, state legislation makes that a little bit more complicated because the parents do have to sign a consent form to use, you know, preferred name and preferred pronouns. That's state legislation. So prior to, the school was willing to use name and preferred pronoun without parental consent. But unfortunately, parents' rights kind of won last year in our state legislature. We also had an issue where transgender youth were being refused the restroom of preference. So we have several youth that were on hormone replacement treatments and were being forced to use the restrooms of their assigned sex at birth. So the school previously had refused to allow students to use the appropriate restroom. We kind of had some education with them about what the laws are, and so then their response was that they were going to let the students use one restroom that's all the way at the front of the school building that honestly none of them can get to within their 3-minute passing period. So we eventually had to go to the school board and won for youth to be able to use the restrooms of their preferred restrooms. So we had a lot of school policies that were changed throughout the course of this process over the last year. One of the most important things is connections to LGBTQIA plus inclusive resources. We had a lot of youth that believed that all of those, I mean, I joke that it was probably 129 churches, but it's really probably not that far off. There are a lot of faith organizations within our county, and the youth believed that all of them were similar to that street preacher that we were dealing with the harassment last summer. And so for the youth to actually be connected with faith leaders and faith organizations within the community that don't hold those same biased beliefs, I think was very healing for them. We actually had, when the street preacher situation was going on, we had a church reach out and say, what can we do for the youth? And so one of the issues that we were running into is the space that we were using was right where he was street preaching. And so we didn't want to expose our youth, and we didn't want any kind of dangerous situation for these children really to go in and out of that organization. So the church opened their basement, which has a large meeting space, to our youth group for free. And our youth still meet in the basement of that church every other week. And the church actually collected, in honor of Pride Month, they collected a donation for our youth to be able to support their meetings and their work. So the church not only opened their space to us, but they also kind of helped open their wallets, I guess. It's a small congregation, but the youth felt really touched that not all people of faith hold the same beliefs as the self-proclaimed street preacher. We also organized the first ever Pride event. So that Pride event connected youth with businesses that support LGBTQIA plus individuals and were open about their support. And so it was really nice for the youth to be able to kind of see these are the businesses that are safe and these are the businesses that we've had some issues with. We had some problems with a music studio that's actually targeting youth. So they teach music lessons at this music studio. And that organization, the person that runs it, has physically assaulted two different people in the last couple of years. The first being some peaceful protesters when Roe versus Wade was overturned. The second being some people who were in, so we had street preacher, right? He calls himself Mr. Batman. So we had Mr. Batman. We had the counter protesters to Mr. Batman that lined up, and this businessman who runs music lessons for children physically assaulted one of the counter protesters. And so we see, youth-led or youth-focused businesses within the county that are anti-LGBTQ plus, and that's been a pretty big concern. And so for them to be able to see what businesses are supportive, what businesses are coming out and really making hate statements, has really kind of shifted where the youth and their families are spending their money and spending their time. And then on top of that, the school refused to depict any kind of same-sex relationships within their sex ed within the school. So we created a Love Notes teen camp. So Love Notes is a curriculum from Dibble Institute that teaches healthy relationship skills. It's also not an abstinence-based program. It teaches for youth to have their long-term goals and then make choices that most align with what their long-term goals are. But the Love Notes curriculum naturally incorporates same-sex couples, it incorporates all kinds of different relationships. And so we have that Love Notes teen camp. I didn't have a photo to be able to add in that. But youth are learning healthy relationship skills, and they're also learning that their relationships are just as valid as any other relationship. We also have a social media manager for Rainbow After the Storm that creates and posts these ally tips. And so there have been a lot of, the youth called them queeros, is the coin that they turned them. So their queer hero of the week is how the youth had identified that. And so they were showing all of these people, out in the big bad world that look like them and that are doing great things. So they were able to kind of identify their heroes, and they were able to have those ally tips and just really kind of doing the anti-stigma, anti-hate education, and it kind of helped a lot of people learn how to be good and successful allies. So. Those are my sources. I would highly recommend you look up Gleason. So it's GLSEN. Their most updated report should be out within the next couple of months, because the most updated right now is 2021. But it's really important that you kind of understand, and honestly reading the executive summary of that report is heartbreaking. As a parent to a son that identifies as homosexual, Mama Bear was ready to come out and I was ready to pull my child out of school And we've dealt with some of that harassment. So I think really reading that and really kind of understanding the plight of some of these young people is really important. Even if you're not planning on, I don't know, jumping aboard my rocking the boat ship and, you know, doing some work. The other is the Common Social Change Library. So learning more about power mapping and understanding what that looks like in community organizing. A lot of these youth already knew what they wanted. What they needed was some education on how to organize the community and how to advocate for what they needed. So we just provided that education and support, and then we stepped back and let them go. And I will tell you, like, youth, because they don't have a fully functional prefrontal cortex, they will take steps that we will never dream of taking, right? Like, risk-taking behavior may be bad for your car insurance, but it's great whenever it comes to community organizing. So those youth have been way more successful than we would have ever considered. I mean, if you want a really heartbreaking story, visit the Indiana General Assembly website. There's plenty of heartbreaking material in there, whether that's LGBTQIA+ or some other set of things. And then you can also check out Wave 3 News, which is our kind of local news station, if you kind of want to see more about Mr. Batman and all the terrible things from his reign of terror last summer. I am pleased to report, though, that he did lose his job. Because he was actively putting out there that his job at a church was supportive of what he was doing, and the church actually came out and said, no, we're not. And he lost his job as a result of being hateful, but that didn't stop the pain that he inflicted for the entire 3 months last summer. All right, thank you. So there's my contact information up there. Or you can check out your app. It's in the app. So are you introducing the next speaker, or would you like me to?
Before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge Andrew Jimenez, who's the program coordinator of our OFR in Riverside County. He couldn't be here because his wife is about to have their first child, or soon, and it was too close to the due date, so I'm here in his stead. And as a note, I'm from California, Southern California particularly, and my notes say good morning because on my calendar, this appointment, my speaking time was showing up as morning. Instead, I'll say good afternoon. My name is Wendy Hetherington, the chief epidemiologist for the County of Riverside Department of Public Health and the principal investigator for our Riverside Overdose Data to Action program. So about us, Riverside County, we're located in Southern California. We're based out of the city of Riverside on the western side of the county. We're home to 2.5 million residents, of which about 48% identify as Latinx or Hispanic. We are the 10th largest county in the nation, the 4th largest in California, and we're home to Palm Springs, California. We experience approximately 800 overdoses a year. We have the highest rate of overdoses of large counties in Southern California, so we have more per capita than Los Angeles, San Diego, and others. So our Riverside, and I'll go quickly through this because I'm sure a lot of you are funded through ODTUA, but just as a brief, prior to 2019, when we received our first round of funding for ODTUA, we had zero formal overdose prevention activities within our Department of Public Health. We occasionally would analyze data, write up a data brief about overdoses, mostly from our death certificate data, but that's it. And I don't know if this is just because I was naive and really didn't know any better, but one of the activities we wrote into our application was an OFR, because I Googled and I said, oh, that sounds really interesting, and I wrote it in, and we established it without, like, really knowing what we were doing. But I think that also benefited us because we went through barriers without even trying to address them, such as, like, involving our county council or other legals that may be a little bit more hesitant about these type of activities. And so we made it work. So, and then in 2023, we got refunded with the second round of funding. We were a little bit nervous there because it was a little bit more competitive, but I'm happy to say we were awarded again, and we have harm reduction, stigma reduction, clinician and health system best practices, linkages and retention to care, and our overdose surveillance infrastructure. Some of the activities include case management services, where we use our public health nurses to work with pregnant or new parents with substance use issues. We support peer recovery support through our Rainbow Pride Youth Alliance group. We partner with our Department of Behavioral Health for hospital peer navigation services. We provide school training, academic detailing with our biggest Medicaid provider in the region. We have an outbreak protocol that we do in partnership with our sheriff and emergency medical services. And then we also produce surveillance reports. We also have an awesome overdose data dashboard, and there's a QR code will take you directly to the dashboard. So where are we now? The data geek in me really loves this slide, and I could spend like 10 minutes just describing it to you. But the main points I would like to point out is we started experiencing fentanyl overdoses for the first time in 2011, but it wasn't until 2015. And fentanyl without methamphetamine is the blue color at the bottom. Methamphetamine has always been the drug of choice in Southern California, particularly in Riverside County, and there's been a slow sort of increase of methamphetamine overdoses since 2009. Towards the end of 2019, early 2020, we noticed this combination of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and now about 90% of our overdoses involve methamphetamine and or fentanyl, and actually two-thirds of our fentanyl overdoses also involve methamphetamine. So what I always like to say is we can't just talk about fentanyl, we have to talk about methamphetamine and the reasons why people use and continue to use and keep them safe. In terms of the Latinx community, what we noticed is in 2022, we noticed that we noticed an increase in the number of overdoses in the Latinx community, while there was a decrease or stable in all the other groups. This is not rates, because as I mentioned earlier, about 48% of our population is Latinx, so they actually tend to have a lower than expected rate, but the numbers were concerning. And so because we experience about 800 overdoses a year, the way we structure our overdose fatality review is by picking topics or themes. And so we identified, using that data, that we should discuss Latinx involved, or people who identify as Latinx and overdose deaths. And so the recommendation is that we wanted to decrease overdose fatalities among the Latinx Spanish-speaking population. We identified this issue in late 2022 and started implementing some recommendations that year, and then up to August 2023. So here's how we structure our OFR. We meet monthly. We have a pre-identified focused area. This is informed through our monthly surveillance data trends. And then during each OFR meeting, the data trends are presented and utilized to facilitate discussions. Some of the other focus areas have been African-American Black women, in-custody deaths. That in-custody death was actually proposed by our sheriff's partner, which was really, I think, great of him to do that. Other ones include, individuals experiencing homelessness. About 25% of our overdose deaths are among people who experience homelessness. And then, again, methamphetamine is a big one as well. In 2022, our overdose fatalities were still increasing, and if we look at overdose fatalities overall, if we look at fentanyl-related overdose fatalities, if we look at methamphetamine-related fatalities as well as in polysubstance with fentanyl and meth all was increasing, but then particularly when we looked by race, ethnicity, it was the Latinx. But I am really curious about that data you presented about, Laura, that you presented earlier about the misclassification of Native American, because we do see a lot of Latinx and Native, and I think we could tease that out a little bit to see what was really driving that increase. When we look at Latinx overdose data trends, again, like across all issues, there was increases, particularly among fentanyl and methamphetamine. So the recommendations is trying to get families to meet loved ones where they're at. One of the themes that came out when we talk about this, and we do have a lot of people who identify as Latinx, Hispanic, even myself, even though I present white, but I am of Mexican descent. You know, our families don't talk about mental health and don't talk about things that could be going on. And so it's really educating families through stigma reduction, education, and awareness, and to increase outreach efforts among the Latinx Spanish-speaking population by 2023 to decrease overdose fatalities among this population through the use of Promotoras. So we develop partnership with organizations with well-established community health worker or Promotoras programs. This include Visión y Compromiso and El Sol. And the Promotoras conducted community outreach and delivered substance use prevention and harm reduction education to the Latinx community. We also, you know, why we chose this method is because they're leaders within the communities and the community we particularly wanted to reach. They have the amazing ability to connect. They have shared language, culture, and experiences of their communities. They're trusted members of their community, and they could help reduce barriers to health education and services. And it results in better health for the individuals, families, and the community. So implementing the recommendation, we partnered with Desert Healthcare District and Foundation, which is another CBO within our county, to conduct outreach in the desert region. As I mentioned earlier, we're home of Palm Springs. The Coachella Valley is an area of our county with great disparities. There's some of the highest, most wealthiest census tracts and zip codes in our country are located there, as well as some of our more are most of need census tracts. There's a large Spanish-speaking population, a migrant farm worker population, and then we have a high number of overdoses. Actually, preliminary data from 2023 indicates Coachella Valley, while most of the other areas within the county have been sort of stabilized in 2023, Coachella Valley is continuing to increase. As mentioned, we partnered with Visión y Compromiso. They reached over 3,000 people through their outreach, and they had over 500 participants in their harm reduction workshops. El Sol educated 51 participants on harm reduction, and the Desert Healthcare District trained over 154 community members on harm reduction, and 181 community members were reached via outreach events where 144 Narcan boxes were delivered. I also would like to point out our Faces of Fentanyl campaign. So I'm trying to think what year it was. I think it was 2021. Our County Board of Supervisors established a fentanyl task force Well, I'm among friends here, but among the muckety mucks of the county. So it was headed by our district attorney. We had a couple of board of supervisors and department heads. And you know, there was this common narrative about fentanyl overdoses in our county where people were thinking it was, you know, younger high school aged kids. And I would go to every fentanyl task force meeting and say, no, the data's not showing this. The data's not showing this. This is not what's happening in our county. And so the marketing team that worked on our Faces of Fentanyl campaign really involved our data and talked to me and my team about, like, what should we represent. Anyways, it's this great campaign, award-winning. You could Google that and find it. But one of the things that we did because of the data and because I was bringing up the increase in the Latinx community in these meetings is that we funded commercials, Spanish commercials during the World Cup. So then just seeing like some of the differences between, you know, the same time period in 2022 and the same time period in 2023, in the Latinx community specifically, overdoses have gone down, fentanyl-related overdoses have gone down, methamphetamine have gone down, although, you know, there is that increase in fentanyl and methamphetamine. We're still continuing the work, and as I mentioned, there's increases in Coachella Valley and some of the other areas in our county, but we're continuing to do this work. Thank you.
Hello? Okay. So I think we're at the point where we're going to go to some Q&A. So we have some microphones. I'm going to walk around and kind of moderate as we go, too. So if we got one queued up here. If somebody has a hand for another one, I saw one here. So we'll just go to this question, and if you guys don't mind sharing here for specific responses. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Shelley Little from the state of Washington. I had a question for Carissa. Was there any strategies to reach medical providers since that medical provider was not wanting to treat the trans person?
The youth did identify that there are issues accessing any kind of health care. Part of the struggle is we have a lack of access to health care providers in general. So the population to provider ratio is about 3,000 to 1, and we have zero pediatricians. We have very few specialist providers. So we've made attempts to have conversations with medical providers. Interestingly enough, we don't have medical providers serving on our suicide and overdose fatality review board at all. We had one that showed up to one meeting. And I think whenever that particular provider realized that that meeting information was not going to be allowed to be written in a book, they were not interested in participating. So we've made efforts somewhat unsuccessful because our medical providers are just not willing to engage.
Thank you. We have a question. Oh, did you have continuation? Are we good? Okay, here we go.
I'm sorry to hear all that too, but thanks for sharing. I appreciate it. I'm Melanie. I'm from Hamilton County Public Health in Cincinnati, Ohio. Question for Wendy. We've recently, at our last OFR meeting, discussed two cases that were decedents of Guatemalan descent, and they didn't have much information. We kind of got into a discussion about, people who might not be citizens of the U.S. aren't seeking the correct medical care because of risks, but then they're also seeking alternatives to illicit drugs for their pain. So do you have ideas as to how we can reach those types of populations? That commercial idea was really, really interesting.
Other than working with community-based organizations that work directly with that community to help them frame the messaging, I think is probably the best approach. Working with maybe the farm working community, the employers. We did that a lot with not with overdoses, but with our COVID-19 and getting our vaccines out to the farm working community. But I think maybe we may have a little bit more resources too in California in terms of working with Hispanic or Latinx community-based organizations, but that's really my best suggestion. There's probably lots of expertise though in this room too, and they probably have good suggestions as well.
Okay, thank you. We have I see a hand back in the corner. Anybody else we can queue up? I'll use this opportunity to plug RX Awareness and the other resources on CDC's website if you need that information. We have made a great efforts to have diversity represented, and there are some Latinx populations there and stories. All right.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Latasha Powers again. I'm with the Georgia Department of Public Health in District 4. My question is, I know what we were speaking a little bit earlier with you specifically, Ms. Wendy, about just kind of getting the children involved. My question is, have you had any strong parent engagement that some of the complications we're seeing in our district?
There have been a couple of vocal parents that I personally have not interacted with, but they have worked their own way through working with our county district attorney and then the California state legislator trying to get drug-induced homicide legislation through. You know, the parents that we mostly do interact with when we do community presentations tend to be more supportive. The parents that tend to be the most vocal, though, are those ones who are looking for someone to blame. And that is a really tough group to work with because, you know, they're looking for someone to blame and, you know, I don't want to speak, you know, it's hard, it's really hard to lose your child to no matter what age they are, and I'm getting of an age now when pretty much everyone less than 50 years old is a kid to me. And so it's really hard. Now, like my director of public health, she interacts with those parents and has been on panels with those parents, and it is hard to get harm reduction and other messaging out to parents who have lost a child to overdose, you know, and working with some of our harm reduction partners, they mentioned, you know, like, you know, how years and years, you know, communities were impacted by overdoses, and now, I don't know, it's just really hard. I'll just leave it at that. It's really hard to work with parents who seem to want to go down the law enforcement prosecution route versus, like, you know, trying to make it things safer to prevent more misery. But we'll meet eventually. Thank you.
Do we have more questions? We have lots of time, so that's the benefit of this session, is that it's time to share or learn. And if anybody else has a question, I can, like, queue up for the next person. I don't see hands. Do I see hands? Sorry if I'm missing somebody. Oh, we have over there, sir. Sorry. Anyone else who wants to have something come to mind or share? Just raise your hand and one of us will come to you next. Oh, right here.
Hi, I'm Wendy. You just mentioned drug abuse, homicide. Did you say something to that effect? What did you mean by that? We've been Googling it and we couldn't.
So I guess, I don't know if it's a California word that we call it, but drug-induced homicide is when someone dies of a fentanyl overdose, there's extra addition, like, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal person, but charging the person who dealt the fentanyl to the decedent with a homicide that way. But we also know, like, looking at the data, that, you know, it's the low level dealers that, you know, they're not the cartels that really, I mean, where the issues are. So that's it's sort of like the in thing right now in California. There's a lot of counties and groups trying to get drug induced homicides on their books.
It's also known as the Len Bias Law.
Thanks. Look at all this collective learning we're doing here. We have another question over here.
So this message is for Carissa. You mentioned about school policies being changed, but then it sounds like it's a lot going on with your legislature too, some good, some maybe not so good. So have you thought about what you would do if there are any more, I guess, laws that would hinder the school policies?
Yeah, so actually we've taken some efforts in that. We had some meetings with our federal legislators in January. made some attempts to reach out to state legislators this year to kind of explain one of our issues, actually, of overall in SOFR is the state legislature stepping in the way. So we've all heard of ESPRT, right? If you haven't heard of ESPRT, that's like the big what everybody wants you to do. It's screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. So in Indiana, it's no longer allowed to have ESPRT within our schools because schools are not allowed to ask questions about a child's mental health or emotional well-being without parental consent and in a way that identifies the specific student. So we've made advocacy efforts as far as legislation goes. I'm sure there's a brick wall around here I could probably bang my head off of and probably be more effective. So.
Thank you. We have a question over here.
Hi, my name's Rode. I'm from the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in New York City, and our OFR is conducted through an interagency collaboration called RxStat, and it's mainly government organizations, municipal mostly, some state, some federal, and it's like NYPD, Department of Health, Department of Homelessness, but it's not very much community agencies, and typically we have historically excluded community agencies, but I'm curious from either of you what has it looked like to bring community partnerships into your meetings or what your meetings look like with including people of lived experience purposefully.
So our population is 24,000 in our county. So we basically have collaborative efforts across the board. Most of our service providers are people with lived experience. So we have a very active recovery community organization. We have a non-syringe harm reduction program. And so they've always been at the table with us. That was actually born out of the HIV epidemic that we had in 2015. So that interdisciplinary collaboration in a rural community, I think, is a whole lot easier than probably what you're experiencing in New York. So you may have a better perspective on what that looks like in a bigger area.
Maybe Jessica, who's our program director, could answer this a little bit better. She's sitting in the audience. But I know we invite our community based organizations, specifically our harm reduction partners, to participate in our overdose fatality review, and they are able to provide perspective of lived experience or others. Other examples of informing some of the gaps or barriers that we find. One of our areas that we're trying to grow in is really involving next of kin interviews to work with the community to get more information, because one of the things that I struggle with is when we do the OFR, a lot of our information or data that we have is from the decedent's worst day of their life through the coroner's report, or you know, through their struggles with previous overdoses through our EMS partners that share data, or through our probation department that shares their data. And they're really snippets of the person, but not really the person, not the individual. And so I think while we're working on incorporating next of kin interviews, I think involving the community, specifically those with lived experience, helps, paint a different picture, because, a person's not just, the worst day of their life.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions or comments?
Yeah, I just had a question going back to the discussion about, I think it was being called homicide deaths that are related to substance use. How soon for both of your counties are you trying to engage people in that discussion after the loss of that loved one? I guess that's my biggest question for both of you.
So our county, we have 18 versus 800, right? So yeah. We review two cases a month. I can tell you that this month we reviewed cases for May of 2023.
Okay.
So we're almost a year out. Our goal is no less than 3 months and no more than 6 months. So we're not quite to that 6 month mark, but we're giving the families time to grieve. Mm-hmm. And so myself, as a mental health provider, whenever I make those calls for next of kin interviews, I explain to them that I am a mental health provider conducting that next of kin interview. We also have a peer that will be going through next of kin interviews as well. And a lot of the families have worked with that particular peer. So I think some of it is like letting them know, like, you have this supportive system. I don't know how everybody does their next of kin interviews, but ours are done by licensed professionals.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And then for your county, is it different for engagement purposes, or?
I was confused about your question because you were talking about the drug-induced homicide, which is really outside our realm in public health, so we don't. I'm not, that's all law enforcement and the district attorney. I don't know how they do their selection.
Okay.
But, you know, in terms of us, we usually tend to, you know, we pick on a topic and we tend to do current year. We don't have an exact rule like you do, but there's been enough time after the overdose to have all the information in. So,
okay.
I don't know, within a few months.
So let me back up and say, I'm from Milwaukee County. I'm one of the social workers who does bereavement support and next of kin interviews. So one of the things that we found, which I guess I'll talk about later, is that when we're doing next of kin interviews, 9 months is the earliest that when we're doing it, that we go, we do that. Before that is a little bit too soon for a lot of families, especially when you get to the question of drug-related homicide, because families, they're looking at it, if the medical examiners determined that this was a fatal loss through due to substance use and it was an accident, families are like, no, somebody intentionally gave them this. And if you're talking to them too early, they're not willing to have that discussion. So that's one of the things we found during our bereavement support calls. So that's why I asked the question.
That's really good to know. So I've never brought up the question about like the homicide statute, because ours just went into effect July 1st.
Okay.
And so that had not been anything we had ever really discussed. Honestly, our law enforcement collects cell phone data and all of that. Mm-hmm. At the onset, I can say our prosecutor is gunning to prosecute. If the person who sold the lethal substance knew that it was contaminated. And so 9 months is a pretty good period of time. I've found that like most of ours are 6, 7, 8 months. So we've had pretty good success with them being pretty open.
Very nice.
But somebody had mentioned in the previous session about like, sometimes you have to also look at that aggregate data, because if parent says, no, it was a perfect childhood, and then there's, you know, mental health data, or there's some other kind of information, DCS data, that says maybe that's not the case, that can be kind of complicated.
So. Yes. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. We have a question over here.
This question is for Carissa. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about the receptiveness in Indiana, Scott County, I believe, with the HIV epidemic, and how open and receptive the community was to the stigma reduction and harm reduction types of campaigns slowly or shortly after the 2015 HIV epidemic.
Okay, so we were the first syringe service program in Scott County. I don't know where you are. I don't know where this question is coming from to like give you my answer. Okay.
Wisconsin.
Sorry, trying to look at you while answering and I couldn't figure out where you were. So it was a circus, you can imagine. Like our governor at the time happened to maybe go on to be vice president during the previous administration. and was really not happy about a syringe service program being started in Indiana, period. However, harm reduction was, you know, kind of all the evidence points there. Stigma reduction didn't really start happening until probably 2018. And we've run multiple like stigma reducing campaigns, and there's been a lot of community shift to understand some of that. Like our SOFR team just recently released 2 of 3 films. Our third one is still in the final editing process, but to talk about the mental health impact on substance use, and grief is actually one of our biggest contributing factors. So when we're looking at those things, the community is very receptive now, but it took some time. However, we had a witch hunt in 2021, and our county commissioners voted 2-1 to shut down our syringe service program. Because our syringe service program was shut down, the state of Indiana will not allow anyone else access to, because the way that the funding stream from Indiana Department of Health works for the data tools for HIV care coordination, because we no longer have a syringe service program, we don't have access to the data tools to be able to provide HIV care coordination. So the county commissioners essentially like not only lost the county a ton of grant funding that we had to repay when they shut down the syringe service program, but we're starting to see an uptick in not just HIV and hepatitis C, but we're seeing struggles with actually testing because of the way that the IDOH system works. So getting people actually tested and entered, so we really don't have accurate data. On top of that, we've lost care coordination. On top of that, we've also kind of lost contact with, we have a non-syringe harm reduction program that was started, but we still have lost a lot of contact with people who are actively using drugs. So it's been pretty devastating to the county, and I think at this point they have no idea what the long-term effects are. I know we're starting to see like injection-related infections ticking back up, all kinds of other health disparities as a result. So they were receptive after some time of like education, but then in 2021, we brought in state and federal experts to explain to our county commissioners that, you know, syringe service, and we had some of the highest like actual exchange rates and success, but they didn't care, they didn't want to hear it. So it really kind of depends on which elected official. There are some people that still disagree with the decision of the two county commissioners, but those two county commissioners had all the power. So
thank you so much. Important insights. Does anybody else have questions? If not, I have some. I'm not seeing. Okay, we have a hand in the back. Anyone else? We do have time.
Hi, my name is Michelle Scott. I'm with the Michigan Public Health Institute. I have a question for you, Wendy. You mentioned going into some spaces with the data and individuals that had some misconceptions about what populations were kind of impacted. How did you go about like saying like, here is your data, like that's not what it's saying? How did you shift mindsets so people could really see, you know, what was there? Because it's hard to address the problem if people aren't able to wrap their head around who it's really impacting.
I think, you know, it's just, I would present the information, I think the meeting was every other month, and we developed what we call a fentanyl one-pager that described our fentanyl-related overdoses, both fatal and non-fatal, in partnership with our EMS agency, and right at the top, one of the boxes, and I'm gonna get the exact age wrong, but at the time, you know, the fentanyl one-pager had like the median age of an overdose in Riverside County is 46 years old. And one of our county board of supervisors saw that, and she just made a comment like, oh my gosh, I thought it was younger, because I think that's what, like, some of, you know, the district attorney and others are trying to get, you know, their work done and sort of paint this picture that it's high school kids. And then I think it was during the anniversary of the fentanyl task force, a video was created, and it mentioned that, I forget what, how they painted it exactly, but it was, they had me review it for the data, and one of the things they had was like 3 out of 5 overdoses in people less than 15 involve fentanyl. And that was true, but that's because there was only 5 out of 100 or 800 people who died of, who were less than 15. And so it was sort of painting this picture that, you know, again, because it's extremely tragic. You know, you don't want high school kids or anybody to die of an overdose, but it's just, I think, just presenting the data over and over and over again.
Thank you. That's great. I think this gets to a bigger question about what are the data and what are the data numbers that you want to share, and sharing a percentage, sharing a number, sharing a proportion, sharing rates, as Wendy touched on a little bit. Those all gather really important pieces of information, yet may not tell the whole story as a single piece, just as Wendy's example really showcased for you. More questions. I'm reading the language in the room. I see another one over here. I am reading the language in the room, and I want to be mindful. So we'll take one more question after this, and then I'll pose a question to our panelists for kind of a takeaway, and then we have a couple of closing pieces. So go ahead.
I was just going to make a comment more than a question. Really, the when you were talking about the perception being high school kids. It's high school kids using fentanyl. In Milwaukee County, we find that our numbers skew much higher, much older. And when I'm making calls to families for bereavement support or next kin interviews, a lot of times they're like, well, no, you know, no, that, I mean, they were older, but, you know, I mean, I'm calling about 70-year-olds sometimes. You know, people in nursing homes, in senior living facilities. And it's surprising to people. It's surprising to families, and I think to other professionals in the field, they don't think anybody over the age of 40 or 50 has that kind of relationship with these types of substances. They think of it as experimentation with youth. So I definitely share that thought as you were presenting that, kind of reflected on that, and it really resonated with me because I hear this all the time. Family's like, no, I mean, he was only using it because he was retired, he was bored, and he wanted to have sex with his girlfriend. I'm like, no, that's not a thing. So this is really a part of what I hear all the time. So just wanted to reflect on that.
Thank you for sharing. These are real stories. Do we have any more question or comment? All right, we see right here.
Thank you. Kevin Hunter from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Just a comment, after Governor Pence approved that first syringe service program, the state legislatures outlawed or made possession of a syringe a felony. So problematic. You know, you're trying to help people, yet the state legislatures really just made a huge error in that.
They have actually, fentanyl test strips are considered paraphernalia in the state of Indiana. So are xylazine test strips, and those are illegal to possess. So I can tell you in Scott County, they won't charge that. However, I'm sure that there are other counties out there that they will charge. There was effort this year for the state legislation to take away and make those, like, to decriminalize those, and that didn't go anywhere. So it died in committee. But yeah, you're right, like, they did. They made possession of a syringe a felony. It's possession, it's, yeah. So it's continue the fight at the State House.
Okay, thank you for sharing. And lots of different policy actions going on. I see we have one more, so I'm gonna hold my question for a second here and just make sure we get this comment in or question.
It really is just a comment. I've been around for a long time and actually had people from Scott County come to our community to work with us. And I just wanna say that you're just absolute fierce advocates, and I am sure that there are many, many families and individuals that are so grateful that despite everything that happens with your laws and everything, you guys just never give up. You just keep coming back and saying, we're going to make the change. I think that's awesome.
That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing. So my one question, and it's just one thing for both of you, is for all of these wonderful attendees to the session, what's one takeaway you want them to take back to their communities? And then we'll do a little closing.
We've heard it repeated several different times, nothing about us without us, right? We knew that we needed LGBTQIA plus supports, but we also were able to recognize that we weren't the ones to make the choice about what that support really kind of looked like. So I would encourage you that if you are making recommendations and making choices for people in your community, that you're making sure to include those voices as part of whatever recommendations and actions that you're taking.
Can I just say ditto? I mean, really, I mean, just listening to the community. I know it's sometimes it's hard when you work in government and you work in public health, specifically when we have like due dates and, you know, grant applications. You know, just earlier this week, we have a grant application for climate change, and you had to identify a CBO to partner with. Now, like maybe 10 years ago, we would have like written it up, submitted it, and then like engaged with the community. This, even though it was hard and we had to rearrange our schedules, we engaged with the community-based organization and got their ideas on board and then submitted with them. So not related to overdoses, that was related to climate change, but I think the similar is true, as hard as it can be. I think probably the best work comes from listening to the community and working with them to really do community participatory programming and engagement.
Great. So we heard the basically listen to our communities. And I think that's just been a general theme that we all know and want to practice, but it's always a good reminder because there are those fast-paced situations, there are those hot button issues, there are the preacher on the corner causing strife in the community. And so we just want to be there for each one of those. Just want to talk here, and did you want to talk about them? So just a little bit more about support.
If you would like to keep this conversation going, you are more than welcome to sign up for our exchange, our email exchange. You can do that on ofrtools.org, and anyone is welcome to submit a question, and anyone can respond. Also, if you have heard something that you think, wow, I would love to know more information about that, please submit a TTA request on our website. We would love nothing more than to get a meeting on the books with you and just talk about your dreams and desires for everything that you want to accomplish and how we can better support you in doing that. Also, if you have maybe heard about someone that is doing something and you think, that's amazing, how can I learn more about that? You can become a mentee. You can also scan this QR code or go to our website, and there's a lot of information there. And also, thank you both for being here today. We're very grateful for you sharing all of your wisdom with us. So thank you.